Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the endarkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the endarkened corridors of power. We shine light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of defending positions. Well, I've said it before, and it looks like it might be a broken record for my Wiki Politiki broadcasts for this coming year. We have a deeply united body politic, in spite of all we see, in the sense that more than three-quarters of us would prefer to cooperate and collaborate instead of fight one another. When this week's guest, visionary activist Norlin Dimmitt, asserted that 76% of Americans want to come together to solve problems, it reminded me of something that happened nearly 25 years ago. I was at a lecture by a spiritual psychologist, Patricia Sun, and she recounted a presentation she had given at a New Age bookstore. Well, outside the bookstore were four fundamentalist Christians picketing her presentation. So Patricia suggested to the bookstore owner that she go out and talk with the picketers, but the bookstore owner said, forget it, you can't talk with those people. But anyway, Patricia went out to converse with the group, and after 10 minutes, three of the picketers put their signs down, hugged her, and said, you're saying exactly what Jesus said. The fourth picketer was unmoved, and he continued to carry his sign. Well, this anecdote led me to postulate what I call the law of 75. 75% of people, three-quarters of us, are susceptible to loving, respectful conversation. Norlin does me one better. His figures say 76%. Furthermore, Norlin is working with an organization, Compassionate Citizens, that is weaving together hundreds of faith-based organizations to help bring about what he calls caring culture, caring economy, and wise democracy. One of the partners, the Listen First Coalition, is billed as, quote, 350-plus organizations working together to mend our frayed social fabric by building relationships and bridging divides. And this, they're empowering what they are calling the National Conversation Project. Norlin's own spiritual history involved being raised in a radically fundamentalist worldwide Church of God, and evolving to one of those rare Unitarians who actually believes in God. He is a mathematician by training. He's an actuary by trade. And his experience in the real estate industry has led to his design of a unique way to fund compassionate conversations. Again, broken record department. For months, you've heard me talk about creating, populating, and empowering a sane and sacred center to fill the vacuum in our society that's been occupied by the unchecked, unbalanced, unmitigated power of money. Can faith-based communities help us bridge a divide and cultivate a unifying and yet inclusive meta-narrative that will apply the golden rule to overgrow the rule of gold? That's what we're going to find out today. Welcome, Norlin.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me on.
Great. Well, let's start at the beginning. Let's discuss that 76% figure. Where did that come from?
Sure. You may know him. Stephen Call is the founder of an organization called Voice of the People. It's at VOP.org, the initials for Voice of the People, VOP.org. A few years ago, Stephen Call launched, back in 2013, in fact, he launched an initiative which he calls the Citizen Cabinet Initiative. And the idea was to have 275 randomly selected folks from every U.S. House district in America to come together, representing all sides of the equation, to be an advisory, a consultative body to advise the U.S. House reps across the country. And in the process of promulgating this idea, this campaign for a citizen cabinet, he, as a pollster, would talk to people, bring them in, randomly select folks, just like a deliberative poll, but to have them dialogue about possibilities. And at the end of the day, over 70% of Republicans, over 80% of Democrats supported this idea after they learned about it and discussed it, of having basically empowering the collective wisdom of we the people. And the number in aggregate turned out to be 76%. Since that was the birth year of our country, 1776, I just talk about the 76ers when I talk about trying to rally 30 million of them by 2028.
Very, very interesting. So let's, you're working with faith-based communities largely. This what's called the Beloved Community Network of 350 organizations. Who are these groups, and how did you find them? And what do you see as
sure.
a possibility?
Sure. Well, let me be really clear that I'm not the one specifically that's managed to pull them all together. A guy named Pierce Godwin, who happens to be a conservative Christian, surprise, surprise, for most people, is the one that had a vision about healing the divisions in America. And years ago, he starts this project called the National Conversation Project to get people talking across our political divides primarily. I am connected to a great number of those 350 organizations, but I've never managed to get them to plunge into the pool. They'll drag a toe in the water. Pierce Godwin and working with Graham Bode, who is a professor of listening. I didn't know that was a topic until I met Graham Bode. There's literally a professor of listening in Oxford, Mississippi at Ole Miss, whose main focus is on the whole science of listening. And so between them, they have managed to get over 350 organizations, including the Charter for Compassion International that I've been peripherally involved with for many years. So I certainly recommend that everybody go out to listenfirstproject.org. It's just called listenfirstproject.org, and take a look at some of those 350 organizations, because some of them will appeal.
You know, it's interesting. The I love the idea of Pierce Godwin. It would be a win for God, I think, for the Tower of Babel to fall and all of these groups begin to converse with one another. And a professor of listening, I love that idea. I guess you go to his class and nobody speaks, or he doesn't speak, he just listens. But I think that that's when I looked at the Listening Project, what struck me was the idea that right now we have these narratives where people are talking over each other. It becomes more important for them to hear what they have to say than to actually listen and reflect on and respectfully to another point of view. What has the Listening Project, what have they done so far? Is it just an idea, or have they begun to
not
work
at all
together?
Not at all. They have been working at a national level, and that distinguished itself from our desire to set up some 10,000 plus individual community projects, so that the community folks get together where they have a more vested interest in their place based where they currently reside. They have a little bit more incentive to work together for a thriving community. But they have been working at a national level, primarily with organizations like the National Institute for Civil Discourse, and the one that I point to quite a lot is Braver Angels, mm-hmm. because Braver Angels has a specific project of piercing, to use another play on words there, piercing the bubbles of division between red and blue. So if you can pierce the bubbles, you can get a win for God. So the Godwin thing really fits together nicely there. But they have been, they are convening. They convene pretty much every 2 weeks. They skipped Christmas for obvious reasons, but they convene every 2 weeks with a group of people from multiple organizations that are working on how do we come together collaboratively to take a story to the public that will rally the troops.
You know, that's really interesting because, you know, so many of the projects that I've noticed are looking for ways of being a better storyteller because, again, it's not so much the facts that influence people, but it's the compelling stories that get to our hearts. And I think that if we look at the story of the $4 billion that was spent on this recent electoral season, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt from that $4 billion. I can see where they're working for that. Do you see that this is primarily a bunch of chiefs getting together, or are they actually, you know, getting into the Indians?
Well, so this is, and I'll distinguish what they're doing from what we are envisioning. Now, ours is just a blueprint, and we haven't launched. We're going to launch our first state pilot incubator of compassionate communities on January 20th, Inauguration Day. Mm-hmm. But what they do is a combination of leaders and audience members that theoretically could be engaged, but real frankly aren't as engaged as they could be, because that's part of the problem here is you get a panel discussion together of six or seven or eight leaders, and you put out a webinar, and a lot of people attend the webinar, but they're not engaged in that conversation. That's why we want to translate that out to 10,000 sets of conversations that are going on in communities across the country, so that we're getting all the way down to the grassroots civic engagement.
Now, you've mentioned in our conversations prior that the platform you were looking at using is the Meetup platform. I'm sure some of my listeners are familiar with it, but why would the Meetup platform be suitable for this?
Well, so there's a couple reasons. My argument for it, I have no shares in Meetup. I'm not going to make any money because somebody spends $15 a month on the Meetup. But Meetup was formed after 9/11, when the founder of Meetup, who lived in New York City after the 9/11 attacks, realized that they had 16 million people and no community. That there was just this hunger for connecting with people. People are living in their little bubbles, their silos, maybe a close circle of friends. And so he launches Meetup to try to re-engage. He had read a book called Bowling Alone, a famous book that was by Robert Putnam, about the fact that the bowling leagues largely disappeared and people no longer do things together. Church memberships dropped off. Rotary club memberships have dropped off. And so the weaving of the community that used to happen with all these associational groups has dissipated largely, and we live this hyper-individualistic culture. So he brought Meetup together to solve that problem. And now the reason I'm interested in it is twofold. Number one, it's been around forever. There are 30 million users, but it also allows the normal social media. You can message each other within it. It provides an archive that allows you to capture, so that when you have meetings over a period of years, as you're coming together to build abundant community where you are through civic engagement and the like, you're basically getting a record of that. Who was in the meeting? That's going to create cross-connection opportunities. Instead of having millions of one-off dialogues that 99.99% of Americans are utterly unaware of, if we could take all of the things that are already happening, all those conversations are happening, and put them under a single silo uniting archiver of compassionate community building, you're going to have a toolkit that's going to facilitate collaboration and conversation in a sustainable way.
Let me ask you a couple of things about Meetup. First of all, you mentioned archiving. So obviously, these conversations can be aggregated and archived and reached.
Well, now in particular, because until the COVID crisis, probably for the next 6 months, all of these meetings are going to be via Zoom. And as you know, Zoom has the capability of recording it. but it's kept there. So when you go out to meetups, say you go to Compassionate Austin down in Texas, Atlanta, Compassionate Atlanta, because that's one that has a meetup already. Compassionate Atlanta is one of the 70 communities in the United States that's already been launched. Anytime you go in there, you can go back and look at all the history of meetings, what has happened. They have all sorts of things that have come together, but they only have one organizer. We're looking to have as many as 50 organizers that are working on all the different silos: gender equity, racial equity, theological division, interfaith, ecumenical work, cross-political, all of the different racial reconciliation is a really big thing right now, where you have people that step up that are passionate about that one thing. They don't have to cover all the bases. They just have to convene once or twice a month to bring together the people that care about carbon taxes or Black Lives Matter. Those groups tend not to talk to each other, but they're all relevant to building a cohesive world that works for all. And so Meetup allows you the potential of having multiple organizers and therefore uniting the silos of compassion.
That sounds good. Does Meetup actually let people know of all of these things happening? In other words, is there like a universal Meetup site where people can find out where all of these things are going
precisely.
On?
Precisely. Everybody that joins the Meetup is able to get notified anytime something happens. They can control how much notification they have. But every member, we want to have 30 million people that join Meetups across the country by 2028 that will, in fact, be notified. That's the whole thing of cross-marketing everybody's cause in one place instead of having 30 different places at 30 different of things that are being followed by a given citizen. There's just one-stop shop for everything happening in their community.
That makes a lot of sense. Norlin, we're going to take a short break right now. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about your history and how this project will come about. This is Steve
Sounds
Behrman.
Good.
We're on WikiPoliticky, and we'll be back very shortly.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. At the Equal Justice Initiative, we believe mass incarceration has to end. There is this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to Black and brown people. We have to confront our history of racial injustice and commit to a new era of truth. There's something better waiting for us, something that feels more like freedom. Truth can inspire change. Please learn more at EJI.org.
Well, hello there. This is Steve Behrman. We're back with Norlin Dimmitt. Norlin, let's talk a little bit about your own background. I'm always curious to see how people find their calling, the twisty-turny path. I was curious because in your bio it said that you were raised in a fundamentalist Christian cult. Tell us about that and how it impacted your upbringing or perhaps downbringing. And how it has impacted your spiritual ideas since that time.
Sure. Well, my father was an ordained minister in the Worldwide Church of God. Just go to Wikipedia and look up Herbert Armstrong, and I will not delve too much into what that cult is about. But I will say that we read the Bible out loud, King James Version, twice a day, 7 days a week, and give you some sense of a flavor of how intensively the devotionals were. But my father was a very unusual and particularly passionate individual who was a true believer, who also had the curse of a frontal lobe injury that he had incurred in the 50s with a head-on collision with a car sitting on a bike back in the days when they had a strip of metal down the middle of the car. So when he thought that he had the right to beat his disobedient wife, which is what a lot of fundamentalists believe, spare the rod, spoil the child, in 1965, at the age of four, I had the horrific misfortune of witnessing a beating that led to my mother's death of a ruptured spleen. So that was not a very good, from a four-year-old, that certainly was not something that says this love, that God is a very loving person. I was taught that God was absolutely an extremely angry and hateful God who pretty much loved to toss most of humanity into eternal hell, and only a tiny percentage of people could escape. So I rejected all of that intellectually, not spiritually, but intellectually at the age of 11. I was a closet atheist, literally locked in a closet for 4 hours, and I came to my realization that I couldn't worship a God that was that monstrous, and told him so, said, prayed to God, which I assumed was a hymn at that point in time, that if you're the God my father worships, I'll rot in hell before I worship you. So I was an atheist from the age of 11 until 1980, when I was 19. After I left the military academy at West Point, I ended up having a very deep breakdown, a crisis from all of my years of violence. I should backtrack a little bit and say I was rescued from this hell on earth at the age of 14 by the Dimmitts, who ended up ultimately eventually adopting me. But at age 19, I lost my one and only girlfriend from high school, and 19-year-olds, their hormones being what they are, I catastrophized that the world would never be worth waking up to in the morning, and I ended up in a mental hospital, and I was offered Thorazine and lithium as the solutions to the bipolar disorder that they assumed I must be afflicted by. And in the process of one of the days that I was watching a gruesome episode of Quincy on TV in the day room, I don't watch violent movies because of my violent past, but I was watching a particularly gruesome a mass murder leaving teeth marks in the victims, and it was just really, really troubling me. But I became aware of this indescribable cosmic force, if you will, but this oceanic wave of just profound sense of being loved by the universe and the okayness of the universe that's more or less just what's described in the literature of mysticism, which I had no knowledge of. I had no idea there was such a thing as mysticism or non-dual awareness. But that was my one single moment of clarity in my 60 years on this earth, where I understood that I was a spiritual being having a human experience, as is often said, and that that the illusion of separateness is the source, the main ignorance that is the source of all evil in the world. Now, at that particular point, I did not call myself Christian by any stretch. In fact, I railed against organized Christianity pretty much from age 11 until 2013, 7 years ago, when I read a spiritual biography of Teilhard de Chardin, written by Ursula King. And when I realized at the end of the book that he never left the faith, it seemed to me he should have left the faith or been excommunicated by the Catholics, but he wasn't. And I started to reengage the idea that maybe there was a strand of Christianity that was salvageable. So I'd been a Unitarian Universalist for decades, but pretty much on the none of the above category. But for the last 7 years, up until last year when I firmly embraced, I got into the inner circle of this ecumenical movement that's all about healing division between Christians, between conservative Christians and progressive Christians, between Catholics and Baptists. And I got deeply connected and became very close friends with the founder of the movement. That was when I took the plunge and thoroughly wore the label, a very tarnished label, mind you, but this label called Christian that hasn't been executed on very well by very many people.
You know, that's, or I guess there's a pun on executed, too. Have you found, this is interesting because this is getting down into the granular aspect of these conversations. Now, you know, what you're talking about is bringing together conservative Christians, progressive Christians. Obviously, they have something in common. Have you been involved with these conversations, and have they been fruitful?
Yes, very deeply. In fact, I'll just relay one of the instances. I was invited. I only met John Armstrong one day before we just bonded deeply. John Armstrong is the founder of what's called the Initiative. The Initiative.org ends with the covenant, the phrase that says that the love of Jesus might exceed all division. I was invited by the second coffee we had. I was invited to the inner circle that he had developed over decades up in Green Lake, Wisconsin, where Christians from all stripes, left, right, Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, broke bread 4.5 hours a day, 3 1.5 hour meals, tables of 6 or 7, where all we did was connect with one another and in our full humanity. So I experienced this. This is back in June of 2019, last year. I experienced it at a deep level. But here's one thing I want to relay. There was a guy sitting next to me. His name was Stan. I had multiple conversations with him because I sat at his table 2 meals out of 3. So I had about, 8 meals with him over the days that we were there. Stan relayed his lesbian daughter. When his daughter came out as lesbian, he says to the group, he says to the table there, and of course, I cannot bless that marriage. Obviously, he's coming from the conservative side of the equation. Mm-hmm. He says, but I made sure that she knew that I would love her until she died. And of course, it disturbed me as a progressive. How dare you not bless the marriage? How dare you not condemn this whole condemning of gays thing, which is out in the Old Testament, right? The gay lifestyle is an abomination before God. But I sat with it instead of judging it. I wasn't about to judge it in front of a bunch of conservative Christians so overtly. So I just sat with it. And I realized that given what he believed, that he did the absolute most compassionate thing that he could possibly do, which is to say, I have to stand on my conviction, but I will not allow that to get in the way of my compassion, and that I'm going to continue to love for you. And by the time it really gestated with me, I realized that the progressives are as intolerant around a certain group of values that are held by conservatives as conservatives are about the values that the progressives hold. And that was kind of a watershed moment because all of a sudden I wasn't the privileged one that just knew how to navigate this. I realized that we had to allow people, if we're going to be truly tolerant, we had to allow them to feel differently. And for example, the most compelling and the most divisive culture war issue in the country, we all know what it is. It's the abortion issue, it's reproductive rights versus fetal rights. And that issue I've been dwelling with and thinking about going back to my, before I even became an actuary in the early 80s, I had a 14-year-old girl who was my stepdaughter, going to be my stepdaughter, come to me begging to be able to have a child because her mother said, you've got to have an abortion. Now, that's choice from the other side. That's the right of a mother to have a baby as opposed to the reverse. Well, I fought for her right to have that baby. It turned out to be a Down syndrome baby, and that ended up, from her perspective, became a tremendous blessing in her life. But my attitude about choice and my attitude about life, I have very strong valuations on both of those sides of the equation. So I have come around to being able to understand how this useless division that's been created artificially keeps us from coming together to do the most basic things like minimizing abortions because there's nobody that wants to maximize them.
You know, while when you're talking about abortions, I mean, obviously we're living in a political system where the two political sides benefit from these wedge issues because they can use them to garner the loyalty of their team. Send us $3. They're threatening our abortion rights. Or send us $3. They want to have abortions and so on. Now, in our conversation a few weeks ago, you had some really interesting ideas to share in terms of the receptivity of significant people in the Catholic clergy to allowing abortions, under certain conditions. So Why don't you lay out that idea? Because I think it's very, it's really key. If we could actually have the majority of people come up with this and go, yeah, we'd go for that, then that issue could be taken right off the board and people would be able to come together around other things.
Right. Well, I'm going to restate things a little bit here, because I don't know any people in the clergy that aren't just adamantly pro-life. Life begins at conception. But what I want to do is to pivot a little bit, and I want to go to something called the Consistent Life Ethic. And if you go to a website called Consistent Life Network, you will see these are all rabidly, if you will, but certainly strongly pro-life people that are saying sanctity of life and justice after the birth are key. Well, of course, the Democrats worry about justice after birth, and the Republicans officially worry about protecting the life right up until birth, at which point we don't care too much anymore, it seems. Well, what they've done is there's a party that's called the American Solidarity Party, solidarity-party.org, I believe, or net, but just look up American Solidarity Party. There's an entire party that's based on that, marrying the conviction that life begins at conception, the sanctity of life, with justice for the mother, justice for the poor, care for creation, and peace. And here's the part where I think we bridge the divide. We don't bridge it right there. That's not going to get us anywhere. But if we give them a full platform to be able to say, you get to say your values, free speech and all, right? You get to say why you believe that life is protectable from conception. It turns out that there is going to be a place where wiser democracy can come in and arbitrate this culture war issue. One of the leading people in this entire movement, this is a bioethics professor at Fordham University. His name is Charlie Camosi, C-A-M-O-S-Y, and he is probably the leading intellectual voice, theological voice, for this consistent life ethic. And he has overtly said a majority of Americans want to support an abortion up until the first trimester. And the minute you get past that, it reverses. There's a majority of Americans that don't want to let you have an abortion except in extreme instances of, you know, life of the mother and severe, you know, brain debilitation, et cetera, where you've got, where it's not going to be a quality life. The majority of Americans don't want that after the first trimester. Well, if you think about what that means, there's an adamantly pro-life guy that believes that meaningful life begins at conception, believes it's murder at conception, acknowledging that they can't ever get where they need to get as a party. He supports the American Solidarity Party if they don't acknowledge the will of the people, because they're coming from nowhere. They're coming from a 0.1% market share, trying to find the best of the Republican and the Democratic parties. So when he said this, and this is the leading intellectual in this party, for me, the light bulb went off and says, okay, great. Wiser democracy has a role in arbitrating that particularly divisive issue, because that 76 I referred to would be supportive of wiser democracy arbitrating it. Probably very few of those 76ers are going to be people that die on the abortion hill one way or the other. You got people that will die on the, I want to be able to have an abortion for a healthy fetus in the ninth month, and we want the death penalty after the morning after pill at the other extreme. Well, those people aren't going to be the ones to join the 76 movement anyway, because they're the ones that have truth. They don't have to worry about acknowledging the possibility of being wrong, and they're probably going to, you know, die on their hill. But there's only 24% split between the two parties if we can wake up enough Americans to this alternative.
You know, years ago, Tommy Attlee of
sure.
Co-intelligence movement, and Tom Attlee was often called upon to mediate between groups and so on. And one of the things that he did, he had this group, a very diverse group, and he had everybody stand up, and they were talking about the abortion issue. And what he did was he had people line up based on how strongly they felt. And so you had people who are at either end, as you said earlier, somebody who is, you know, life begins at conception, that's it. And the other people, abortion is fine in any condition. And Charlie Camosi, by the way, issued a statement months ago saying that he could never support Mayor Pete because Mayor Pete said abortion is fine in all cases. Here's somebody who's saying, you know, on that extreme, I can't support that extreme. However, I recognize that if we are to move together as a people and have this larger platform that involves a beloved community and up-leveling everyone, then we're going to have to make an adjustment that way. So in looking at this issue, anyway, Tom Attlee had people line up, and of course they were people at the extremes and people at various points in the middle. And then he asked the people who were kind of, you know, in between, not in the middle and not at the ends, what would it take for you to move closer to the middle? And so they created a conversation that empowered these kinds of compromises. Whereas, well, I guess if it were within 12 weeks, I could support that. And on the other side, well, I guess that if you want to limit late-term abortions, except in the case of the mother's health and so on, I would be in favor of that too. So once you liberate these conversations from the rigidity of positionality and ideology, you can have some flexibility. So then the question is, in the course of your conversing with these people, did you see in these conversations, you mentioned the one with the man who was having issues with his daughter, do you see that people can actually begin to accommodate one another so that we can move ahead together?
Well, absolutely. And the minute that we get away from the extremist view, which very few people support anyway, you automatically get that. Jim Ruff has done similar things with Wise Democracy for these dynamically facilitated meetings, where he's done amazing things to get 90% consensus around how do we go forward and deal with the issue, because it's not about conceding. One of the things we have to learn to do as human beings is to give up on transforming another human being. We just have to. We have to give up on the silliness that we're going to get somebody else to see things our way. What we have to do is to assume that they're going to see things their way forever and say, now, given that, how can we go together because we also value democracy? It's not that democracy is intrinsically pure or truth or anything else. It's that we live in a constitutional democratic republic, and there is an awareness. And the more intelligent people are on either side, the intelligent people I know on the left and on the right, recognize pragmatically that civil war is not cool and that we have to find a way to come together. And then we say, well, democracy becomes the way we arbitrate our differences. There are scenarios where nobody supports the answer and everybody supports the fact that the democratic process gave us that answer. A perfect example is how much welfare money to give to a temporarily unemployed single mom. Well, everybody will have a different answer. The super progressives will want a bunch of money, $2,000 versus $600, right? Looking at the COVID relief package here as an example there. Nobody might support that middle-of-the-road number, but everybody can support, or the vast majority will support, the way we got at that number, which is, you know what, it was a fair process. And so looking at democracy as a way to arbitrate our deepest differences becomes a way to turn the tide against the two-party division, which, by the way, is thoroughly anti-democratic. It's impossible to have a more anti-democratic system than a two-party system. It's impossible. There's no way to construct an anti-democratic part that's a so-called democracy where people show up and vote. Two parties maximizes the factionalism, and it maximizes the fringes, because the fringes are the most dissatisfied with the status quo. And so the 76 in the middle just get carried along for this hyper-partisan ride that none of them wants to be on.
Okay, good. We're going to stop right there for the moment, take a break. We'll be back very shortly with Norland Dimmitt and talk about how we're going to bring this about. This is Steve Behrman on WikiPolitiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America. 200 food banks strong.
We're back with Norlynn Dimmitt. Norlynn, I want to really comment on what you were saying before the break, and that is that democracy, that in a certain regard, when people have their faith in this way of making decisions, in other words, it's an acknowledgement, and I appreciate the acknowledgement, giving up on transforming other people's belief systems. Once you begin to do that, then you have a space of respectful listening. All kinds of openings can happen. So in this last segment, I want to talk more about how we bring this about. Now, I understand you have a background as a mathematician and an actuary, and I understand you're using these skills to create sustainable support for compassionate citizens and compassionate conversations. Tell us more about how your experience in real estate and as an actuary has helped you create this idea.
Sure. Well, and I'll just real brief. I don't want to spend more than about a couple of minutes on this because I have the basic story. People can go out to our website, compassionatecitizens.us, and click on the Connection Realty button. But I was an actuary for 11 years. I made hundreds of millions of dollars for Life of Virginia, and I made $500 million of blueprinted for Zurich Direct using predictive analytics, which is essentially fancy statistics to be able to predict more accurately, but applying that to coronary risk assessment so that we could better assess whether you're going to die from a heart condition or not, and therefore kick out the right people and accept the right people. Very capitalist, right? Let's just make money off of death and carnage. This is in my capitalist days before 1995. But I took that same principle of predictive analytics and applied it to residential brokerage to be able to know when to hold and fold on real estate transactions, and did and ran for 17 years, ran a real estate company, Connection Realty, where I helped 160 home sellers get more for their house that I could demonstrate. Well, we are trying to convert that. I've been sitting on the intellectual property because we want to replicate me 10,000 times, basically, and across the country, and tap perhaps 10% of an $80 billion a year industry to be able to provide the kind of funding for this deliberative democracy party, if you will, that the Republicans and the Democrats are able to raise. You mentioned the $4 billion earlier. We know that we need that scale of money to truly get out there and engage the public. Nobody's going to show up to lose an election. Very few people are. So we have to have enough budget to take on the RNC and the DNC if we're going to ever build a transpartisan middle. But that's about as much as I want to say on the money side of this equation, because I'm much more interested in what the target market looks like. Who can we get to, and why can we get to the 30 million people that I believe is necessary to get to critical mass for this wiser democracy movement?
Good. So why don't you jump on that track and talk more about those people and accessing those people?
Sure. So So I could tell you who won't get 30 million people on board. I've been pounding the pavement for the last 5 years, 60 hours a week, and you already know this. I have maybe a dozen people in the pool. Now, they happen to be visionaries and leaders, and that's great, but we need 30 million people. And what I decided quite a couple of years ago, Howard and I decided that the only way that we're ever going to get to 30 million people is to focus on faith organizations, for specifically Christian faith organizations, because the cool thing about the Christian faith is if you can get past all of the garbage, if you can get past all of the, you know, man making God in man's image in the Bible, Jesus, as far as I understand the life of Jesus, and certainly the words that are on in the Gospels and the words that Paul talks about when he's on my wavelength there, was truly a guy who had non-dual awareness, mystical moments more than I did, and had this true awareness of loving your enemy as not only loving your enemy, but loving them as yourself, loving your neighbor as yourself. That seems almost impossible for us. The only stance from which you can make a statement like that, even aspirationally, is to be aware of the imperative, the illusion of separation. And so I believe that the Christian faith, even though they might be operating at a lower level of Maslow's hierarchy, let's say at the love and belonging level for the Methodist potluck dinner as their sense of community, nevertheless, they're embracing a faith that has those words, love your enemy, blessed are the least of these, right? Even as you did to the least of these, you did to me. All of these things that ultimately call us to love our neighbor as ourselves, including the great commandment itself, Matthew 22, is in fact pretty high up the spiritual evolutionary trail in, as you well know, the spiral dynamics model or the Maslow model of ego transcendence, which is the core of all world religions. There's not a single world religion that doesn't have ego transcendence as one of the values. So we've got a lot of people that may not be able to understand why they're supposed to love their enemy, but they know they're supposed to. And that's not insignificant. That's extremely significant. But what we need is for their faith leader, the guy they already trust, the priest, the pastor, the minister, to say, look, we're going to be part of this Charter for Compassion, Compassionate Communities initiative here, because we want to be credible witnesses for our faith. And that's going to be how we get. There's over 300,000 churches in America, over 300,000. And we can imagine most of those 300,000 churches not wanting to be to see the train leave the station, wanting to be part of this. And just real quickly, I'll let you know why I have so much confidence in this. For years, I worked in meetups. I went to these meetups that were about dialogues across difference, that were run by Southern Baptists. I kid you not, I will repeat, Southern Baptists were the ones doing the dialogues across difference. Now, they were young. I've never yet met over 60 or over 50 folks doing this work. But these 20-year-olds, these 30-year-olds that are out there, young evangelicals for climate action, they are a different breed, and the youth is where the hope has to lie here. So getting folks to get, especially at the youth level, to show up in droves to be credible witnesses for their faith, most of us in America are willing to have a competition of ideas. We're not trying to force something down somebody's throat, typically. The average American realizes that we need to just have a vigorous discussion about these issues. So giving the Southern Baptist an actual platform and saying, hey, you get to say your truth, but we get to say ours, that's the whole Listen First idea. That's the Listen First project. Again, not mine, Pierce Godwin's, but his vision is to be able to bring us together across difference to acknowledge, even if it's transactional, even if I'm only listening to you because I really so desperately want to be listened to, we can all fake it till we make it.
You know, it's interesting. What we're really looking for in this period of time, given the near-death experience that democracy had, we're looking for transformation. And, you know, there's three kinds of change. There's transactional, like you just talked about, basically at the level of linear symptoms. Transformation means that you actually change levels. You change to a different playing field. And as I'm coming to understand, often in order to go from transactional to transformational, you need to go to transcendent. You need to have like your significant emotional experience that you had when you were 19, or the near-death experiences that people have, or the other life-changing experiences where, like, for example, Malcolm X going to Mecca and finding that there were white Muslims. They were all praying to the same God and so on, and he came back from Mecca with a certain level of enlightenment about we're all being in this together. I see a great opportunity here because it's the opportunity for people to not give up their brand or not give up their faith, but at the same time to be able to encompass another person's viewpoint and essentially rehumanize that person.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And let me just throw in real quickly on that. I don't mean when I say we have to stop trying to transform other people. It's the whole honey vinegar thing. Nobody, you automatically put up barriers when somebody else is trying to get you to change how you feel. Most of the studies that have been done on transforming prejudice by social psychologists, just to look at that example, it's been the engagement itself. And I look at it as an invitation that implicit to every dialogue across difference is an invitation to expand the perspective of both parties. And if people go into conversations with this idea that that will happen on occasion and we give up trying to compel it and we make it always invitational, hey, here's what I believe. And you discover that I'm not nearly the monster. I'm not eating babies every day. I'm not killing them or eating them, which is what some, and I'm serious, there's actually people out there, as you probably know, that believe that every Democrat, every progressive is part of this pedophilia cabal that's sacrificing and eating babies, which is beyond ludicrous. But it's the fact that we, when we get into this demonizing mode, once the other person becomes the enemy, it's really nice if we can make them even more hateful so that when we exterminate them, we don't feel so badly. If we can go back and humanize one another, what we do is we begin to dispel those things. If we don't push on the one side, if we just say, I want you to know who I am and I want to know who you are, that simple declaration of intent, even if it's partly transactional, if we're really honest, for most people, we're not going to be operating from a non-dual awareness perspective. But if we are genuinely trying to understand and we are affirming them, just basically Carl Rogers' unconditional positive regard, I'm not going to judge you. Christians say, they have a saying, hate the sin, love the sinner. That was what the guy did that I talked about with the gay daughter. I'm going to love you till you die. I cannot bless your marriage. Those don't sound consistent, but they are when you dig deeper, because you can't force him to give up his conviction. And I never spent 1 minute trying to convert him to the gay rights agenda.
You know, one of the reasons why there's so much resistance, you know, people go, why did so many people vote for Donald Trump? I think a lot of it has to do with the heavy-handed way the progressives impose the doctrine of tolerance. We tolerate everything except intolerance. We're very intolerating of intolerance.
And we define intolerance. We define intolerance, and we define it in such a way that is truly offensive at a deep level to conservative evangelicals.
Yeah, say more about that. Say more about that.
Well, so for example, the perfect example is the gay rights thing. So here's a guy, Stan, absolutely would defend the civil rights of his daughter, doesn't want his daughter to be discriminated against, wants her to be able to go into shop and buy what she wants. He just was not willing to bless a marriage that he considered to be a sin. Well, people on the left will absolutely knee-jerk, judge him as an absolute bigot, and I would take real offense. I would be standing up for, even though I completely disagree with him on his stance, I would stand up for him, and I would call the progressive the bigot.
You know, I think that that's really very interesting because, again, I think most people would agree at this point you should be able to marry whoever you want. However, when one's free speech is curtailed, when you are told from the top down you have to use certain words and not use other words, it's certainly not as effective as if somebody comes up with that realization themselves, going, you know, I recognize that that term is offensive to that person. And because I don't want to be hurtful, because I want to be kind, because I want to express those quote-unquote Christian values of kindness, I will not use that word. But when people are pushed up against the wall, you know, I think political correctness brings out the 9-year-old boy in everybody. You know, like, you can't tell me I can't do that, right? So,
Right. No, exactly. So, and go ahead.
No, go. We've got about a minute left, so I put your website on the link to the page. So when people come to our page at Om Times or Wiki Politiki or Mobilized, they'll be able to link to your work. In the minute that we have left, what message do you want to get across to our listeners that you want to amplify?
I would love for every listener to take seriously the idea of convening, of stepping up as an organizer of the Compassionate Community Meetup in their community, to have a meeting a month, if not more. That's all the commitment. It's all volunteer. Nobody's going to pay you for this. That is about dialogues across difference and empowering dialogues that are going to move your community towards a more thriving community for all.
We've got our work cut out for us. Thank you, Norland Dimmitt, for sharing how we can actually come together in fruitful conversation, in compassionate conversation. This is Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. We're back with you next week. Check out Norland's information on our site and become a compassionate citizen and a compassionate conversation. We'll be with you next week.